Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Three Judges or One Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 8, 2015, the Supreme Court decided Shapiro v. McManus. In this case, several Maryland citizens sued state election officials claiming that a 2011 redistricting plan violated their rights to political association and equal representation under the First and Fourteenth Amendments. Although federal law normally requires such claims to be heard by a three-judge federal court, a single judge dismissed the suit for failure to state a claim, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit affirmed. The question before the Supreme Court was whether a single-judge federal district court may determine that a claim governed by the Three-Judge Court Act is insubstantial, and that three judges, therefore, are not required. Not because it concludes that the complaint is wholly frivolous, but because it concludes that the complaint fails to state a claim under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 12b-6. By a vote of 9-0, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Fourth Circuit and remanded the case. Justice Scalia delivered the opinion for a unanimous court, holding that the citizens' redistricting challenge was not so insubstantial that it could be dismissed by a single judge and should have been considered by a three-judge court. To discuss the case, we have Michael T. Morley, who is assistant professor at Barry University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Morley.
Earlier this week, the Supreme Court issued a unanimous ruling in Shapiro v. McManus, overturning the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Shapiro addresses the circumstances under which a case must be heard by a three-judge panel of the Federal District Court rather than by a single judge, as typically occurs. Congress has specified that certain types of issues, including constitutional challenges to congressional redistricting, state legislative reapportionment, and certain provisions of campaign finance law, must be heard by three-judge panels of the district court. Plaintiffs generally view such panels as highly desirable because federal law generally allows litigants to take an appeal as of right directly from such a panel to the U.S. Supreme Court, rather than having to appeal to a federal circuit court of appeals and then seek certiorari from the Supreme Court. The Three-Judge Court Act, 28 U.S.C. Section 2284, provides that a three-judge panel shall be convened when a litigant files certain types of lawsuits, such as a redistricting challenge. When a litigant in such a case files a request for a three-judge panel, the trial judge must, quote, immediately notify the chief judge of the circuit, who shall designate two other judges, unless that district judge, quote, determines that three judges are not required. The case turned entirely on the meaning of that last phrase. The Fourth Circuit had held that a single district judge must determine whether a three-judge panel is required by reviewing the allegations of a complaint on their merits to decide whether the plaintiff had stated a claim and can survive a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6 under the Twombly-Iqbal pleading standard. The Supreme Court flatly rejected this reasoning. It began by noting that, under the plain language of the Three-Judge Court Act, if a plaintiff files certain kinds of constitutional challenges, a three-judge court shall be convened. The law eliminates any discretion that a trial judge may assert to refuse to convene such a panel. The statutory language stating that the district judge must determine whether a three-judge court is required, the Supreme Court held, requires that trial judge only to confirm whether the claims in the lawsuit fall within the Three-Judge Court Act. It does not allow her to review the merits of those claims or determine whether the plaintiff has stated a valid claim. To quote the court, all the district judge must determine is whether the request for three judges is made in a case covered by the Three-Judge Court Act. No more, no less. The court went on to note that it was retaining a jurisdictional exception that it had first recognized in the 1973 case, Goosby v. Osser, in which the court had construed an earlier version of the Three-Judge Court Act. Under the law as it currently stands, the court held, a single judge still may decline to convene a three-judge panel if she concludes that the plaintiff's claim is insubstantial, meaning that it is wholly frivolous and therefore insufficient to invoke a federal court's jurisdiction. The simple fact that a complaint might fail to state a claim, the court emphasized, neither makes the complaint frivolous nor means that a three-judge court would lack jurisdiction to adjudicate it. The petitioners in Shapiro had challenged the constitutionality of Maryland's most recent congressional redistricting scheme. They alleged that the districts violated the First and 14th Amendments because they were politically gerrymandered in what the Supreme Court itself characterized as crazy quilt results. The Shapiro court held that this claim cannot be deemed insubstantial or wholly frivolous, and that the district judge therefore erred in dismissing it himself. Thus, the immediate consequences of this ruling for the petitioners will be to allow them to litigate their case before a three-judge panel of the U.S. District Court, and, if they lose, appeal their case on the merits back to the U.S. Supreme Court. One other noteworthy aspect of this ruling is that the court held that a claim cannot be deemed wholly insubstantial or frivolous if it is, quote, based on a legal theory put forward by a justice of this court and uncontradicted by the majority in any of our cases. The petitioner's claim of political gerrymandering had been based on Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Vieth versus Jubilierer, despite the fact that the four-justice plurality held that political gerrymandering claims were not justiciable. Thus, Shapiro creates even stronger incentives for attorneys litigating redistricting and campaign finance cases to carefully mine concurrences and dissents for assertions or theories that might bolster their claim for a three-judge district court, thereby guaranteeing those attorneys a fast track to the U.S. Supreme Court, even when their theory is in some tension with existing precedent. Shapiro likewise creates new incentives for justices seeking to nudge the law in different directions to be even more generous with their dicta and personal reflections in concurrences or dissents. Beyond its immediate consequences for the plaintiffs, Shapiro maintains, and through its embrace of language from concurrences and dissents, arguably slightly expands the availability of three-judge courts for litigants in certain types of constitutional cases. The Fourth Circuit's ruling allowing single judges to dismiss redistricting cases, and by extension campaign finance cases, for failure to state a claim, was anomalous and in tension with a substantial amount of Supreme Court precedent dealing with three-judge courts. By maintaining this channel of direct access to the Supreme Court, Shapiro makes it easier for the court to hear cases that might not have warranted certiorari, thereby facilitating continued development in constitutional doctrines concerning both redistricting and campaign finance law. Shapiro is also a victory for the rule of law. The justices put aside their feelings about the underlying merits of the petitioner's constitutional theory and applied well-understood and long-standing doctrines concerning the scope of federal jurisdiction to reach a unanimous ruling concerning a procedural issue in a political gerrymandering case that, at heart, is likely to be quite acrimonious. To a community of lawyers and scholars that has seen passionate disagreements on the court concerning a wide range of issues, it is heartening to see that, even in matters of election law and voting rights, justices retain their ability to come together, reach the right ruling, and maintain the fabric of the law.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.